I'm Susan Louvet with Women's Focus, and today I'm talking to Gail Feldman about her new book and one of many books that she's done, but her new book that's called Midlife Crash Course, A Journey from Crisis to Full Creative Power, and I sort of like the irony of that title. Maybe before we start talking about the book, we should tell about the event that's happening the day after this interview, so we be sure to get that in, and then we'll tell more about it later.
That would be great, yes. I'm doing a workshop, Rainbow Your Life, based on the Midlife Crash Course and structured around the idea of the hero's journey. And that will be at High Desert Yoga and Healing Center on Copper from 2 to 5 on Sunday afternoon, the 15th.
And are you taking walk-ins?
Sure.
Okay, we'll get back to that later. But let's talk about the book now. I can see with all that you've gone through and all the especially the experiences and the healing that you found, that you'd want to share your experience with other people. But you're so honest with it. I don't think that you even changed the names of the people that you were in contact with for the book's purpose.
Well, you know, Susan, I did change the names of two people at their request.
Oh.
But apart from that, and those are two women who are in my women's group, my mighty women's group. But everyone else was okay with me using their real names. So it's very much a memoir in that sense.
Well, actually, the other thing I was thinking about is that you don't portray yourself always in a very positive way during the book. And so that must have been hard.
It was hard, but, you know, I had to be honest. The fact is that following my divorce after 34 years and then a heartbreak and then an accident involving broken bones and a head injury, I was so impaired. And I didn't want to write a book, by the way. I was sort of talked into it down the road when I actually could function again and sit at a computer for months. I couldn't use a computer. I couldn't watch TV. I was terribly light and sound sensitive, so all I could do was lay in a darkened room and listen to nature sounds on a CD. So when it came time that I was functioning better, I began to notice that there were other women who were really struggling with some similar things. In fact, it's been shocking to me how many other people have had head injuries.
Oh.
I mean,
I didn't know that.
Yes, it's really shocking. And I, of course, done some research. And the fact is that 2 million Americans in the next year will have a TBI or a traumatic brain injury. It's very common. And this is separate from our vets who mm-hmm. are coming back. Mm-hmm. So I did a draft, a first couple of chapters, and gave it to a colleague who got back to me and said, I think you saved my life. And I said, what? I thought I knew this person. And she said, no, you didn't know that, you know, my husband left me. I lost all of my retirement fund, all of it in a scam. And I had to have hip replacement. So I realized if you could get through everything you got through, I could get through what I'm going through. That was so inspiring to me. So I felt like the book was a calling. I really didn't want to write the book. It was very painful.
The experience?
It was very painful to go back over all of the losses and literally the headache pain. It came back while I was writing the book.
Well, I want to talk about the women's group that was not the outcome of the book, but part of the outcome of the mm-hmm. book. Or of the experience. But let's go back to the beginning of the period when you first started, where the book begins, and talk about what happened to you that was so traumatic at that point. Just tell us a little bit about that incident.
The book starts out with me going on a ski trip in Colorado on Valentine's Day in order to get away from all of the breakup with someone that I thought was going to end up being my next husband and so on, and having been crashed into on the ski slope by somebody, and that ended up in a broken shoulder, and a head injury. And I referred to that a moment ago. Part of what was happening following that time when I was so impaired is that I needed help, and I had to learn to ask for help.
I know. I was surprised sometimes when people would say, go to this doctor, and then you said, well, I didn't.
I could only deal with one thing at a time. And initially, I could only deal with the pain of the broken bones and get through the MRIs and the wondering if I was going to have surgery again and so on, because I had broken up that shoulder before. So all I could do was handle one injury at a time. So I would put off medical appointments until I felt like, I can handle the next step now. But part of the learning for me along the way was that we all need to learn to receive care. You know, I was always the go-to person. Mm-hmm. I was always the person who was going to help others and take care of things for other people.
Let's put this in context and talk a little bit about what your practice is or was at that point,
mm-hmm.
What you did.
Well, I'm a clinical psychologist, and I ended up with a specialty in trauma. So I was the person who would handle some of the most complicated trauma cases, trauma in the sense of physical, emotional, mental, people who have been not just abused but brutalized. And so that was my practice.
And you felt as though you needed to maintain your practice during your own experience because your patients needed you.
Right. And, of course, as soon as I could then, as soon as I could sit up for 1 hour or so at a time, I would go back to the office and sit up for 1 hour and then lie on the sofa with my ice packs. And so I did that the best I could, and it really was a driving force, I think, in my healing.
To keep you going.
Yes.
Let's move ahead a little bit and talk about, that's kind of the difficult part of the book, and the difficult part of both writing and reading it, I think. But I wanted to touch on your experience in Vietnam, which comes towards the end of the book, because mm-hmm. it's so inspiring and kind of beautiful. And I just really enjoyed reading that part.
I enjoyed experiencing that part, finally, because if we put this in the context of the hero's journey, which I do, you know, the call to change and being on the road of trials and being in the belly of the whale and thinking you're never going to, you know, I mean, death is a certainty at that point in your mind. So getting to that place at the end of finding the treasure, that happened when I went to Vietnam. I was invited to give a talk for the Creativity and Madness Group, which is the Institute of American Medical Education. And I never had a sense that I wanted to go to Vietnam, but somehow I knew I just had to do that. And it was so fantastic. It really sort of culminated in my healing because I hadn't given a talk in years. I had no memory. That was part of the brain injury. And so I was really concerned about whether I could do it. But I gave a talk on two amazing men, Michael Naranjo, who is a sculptor in Santa Fe, who was blinded in Vietnam, and Jacques Lusseron, who was a blind French resistance leader during World War II. And these were such inspiring men that I could give the talk. But it was so amazing to me to be able to walk. There was another accident before that where my leg was broken. And I just felt like I was supported, you know, divinely supported to be able to make that trip and to be at the Shangri-La Hotel in Bangkok where I never wanted to leave. That was, boy, that's, you know, being on the mountaintop in the hero's journey, not wanting to return.
Not wanting to return to New Mexico, you mean?
Well, not wanting to return home.
Or to life.
To life, yeah, to real life. It's like wanting to stay in the fantasy of, you know, being in paradise, actually.
Well, but also it's so ironic to be talking about a Vietnam vet who was injured in Vietnam and to be doing that so many years later in Vietnam.
Yes, yes. It was just perfect. It was so, it was such an inspirational talk. Dr. Panter, who runs the organization, invited me to give it the following year in Santa Fe, and there were 1,200 people there, and Michael Naranjo came with his wife. So he got to be honored by this huge group of people. It was very special and very inspiring.
The other thing that was interesting about him, or maybe I should have realized this, but he makes sculptures that you can feel.
Yes. Yes, and he's been instrumental in having museums and displays of art, especially sculpture, be open to people to be able to touch, because there is a blind population that most of us don't know much about.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's made that happen, and he teaches, and it's utterly amazing to me that a blind man can use power tools and create beautiful sculptures.
Yeah. Did you describe to him the experience when you got back from Vietnam of what it was like to talk to the people and to kind of, you saw some of the aftermaths of the war?
Mm-hmm. Well, what I really saw at this point was that Vietnam is a very young population. You know, many of the older people were wiped out during the war. It's a very young, vibrant, energetic population. They are really rebuilding their country. And it was very comfortable being there, and it's very beautiful.
So he must have been happy to hear that.
He was. He's not had any interest in going back there, of course, but he was interested in hearing that.
You go through so many, in very minute detail, the different therapies that you tried,
mm-hmm.
or that not just tried, but that worked.
Yes.
But the different kinds of therapies that you found at different times,
mm-hmm.
because of different pains that came and different experiences that you had. And first of all, I want to hear a little bit about that, but I wonder if you hadn't been in New Mexico, if you would have been able to find some of those people.
Hmm. I don't know, but you know, one of the quotes that I loved throughout this period of time is Louise Hayes saying, "Whatever you need will be provided, whatever you need to know will be revealed." And that was really supportive of me. So I trusted completely. When someone said, "Well, you need to do somatic experiencing," I said, "Okay, I know someone who does that." Okay, I should do that. I'll do that. And if somebody said, "Well, I was familiar with acupuncture, and so acupuncture was helpful," but there were other treatments that I experienced that were really profound and helpful, and these people would just appear, you know. So yes, there were lots of alternative methods and I had a fabulous Rolfer. I had a fabulous team of cranial sacral couple who do that. They were my daughter's teachers.
And maybe we should stop and explain what that means, what a Rolfer is and what a cranial sacral.
Yes. Well, I don't know that I can explain it well, but Rolfing is a type of body work where I think they use pressure points, and it's a very deep work. And I describe in the book where, you know, Brian was working on my left foot at one point, and I started screaming in agony. And I said, "Well, why does this hurt so much?" And he said, "Well, because this point is related to your right shoulder, which, as you will remember, is broken." You know, so there were things in my body that I had no idea, you know, could be connected in such ways. So the Rolfing is a form of body work. Cranial sacral comes under the heading of massage. It's a very gentle work with the spinal fluid in the body. And that's about as far as I can go on that one, but it was something that was very helpful to me.
You are listening to Gail Feldman talk about her new book, Midlife Crash Course, The Journey from Crisis to Full Creative Power. I'm Susan Lube for Women's Focus. Did you find anything that just didn't work or that made things worse? You didn't, in the book, you didn't say that.
No, I can't think of anything at this point, right off the bat. It just seemed like everything I did I was supposed to be doing.
So you accepted what people suggested.
I did.
And found someone to do what they suggested.
Especially, and it all worked. Especially if more than one person suggested it.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Like the trip to Hawaii, the third person who said, you have to get to Hawaii, knowing that Maui is my spiritual home, the third time I thought, oh, well, I better pay attention, but I have no idea how I could possibly make that trip. And then it turned out that my youngest daughter said, Mom, I'll take you. Come on. You got to get there. You
know? And that's something else that was happening during this whole time that you were, I mean, it wasn't just you had this experience and then you healed because you had other experiences that sort of were brought you down again. It was
yes.
a kind of up and down journey. But you also had your two daughters and their and one daughter's family the whole time that were taking your time and your energy and your focus.
Yeah. Yeah. I had, my grandsons were very small then, so and I wanted to continue to be a part of their lives. But one of the things that I really did have to work on, and that's why the group came about, because even though it sounds like, you know, I have family and, you know, I have friends, I live alone. And when you're impaired or injured and living alone, it can be terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know sometimes if I would wake up in the morning. And so I had to bring together a group of women so that I really felt like I had a support group. And then it turned out, as always, that it was a gift to them to be able to come and talk about their own issues, some of which were related.
And this group was called
Mighty Women. And, you know, I call them that because my son-in-law teases my daughter and I. If we do something really great, you know, say, oh, you are so mighty. So I named our group the Mighty Women. And, yeah, I was just going to read you our little motto here. A mighty woman is aligned with her power mentally, emotionally, and spiritually. She has let go of all limitations, those invisible chains that held her back from her highest self-expression. A mighty woman lives in all possibility.
And was this a group that you met with or that came individually?
No, we met together as a group. Yeah.
And how did that work?
We would come together and we based our sessions on the Native American tradition of the talking stick. So we would come together, we'd have a meal prayerfully and visit, and then we would have a sharing circle and we would have a talking stick. In our case, it was a talking duck.
Duck, yes.
I have a little ceramic duck. And pass it around, and each person would be able to share as much as they felt like sharing with no interruptions and no commentary until the end. And then we would have a closing. And then people could talk if they wanted to share more. But it was very much an honoring of each person's ability to handle whatever is happening in their life.
And do you still do that?
We don't because the Mighty Women went off in different directions. Some of them moved away. Several of them got married. So it's, you know, change is inherent in our lives.
Mm-hmm.
So after a couple of years, things changed.
Okay.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
That's a great. Are you suggesting to other that women come to these presentations that you do and that they set up groups like that? Are you using it as a model?
I do recommend that women, again, when they feel the need. Because when we're struggling with life crises, you can feel very isolated and very pressured, you know, to just handle everything on your own.
Mm-hmm.
And we just need to have more and more a feeling of community. So I do suggest that people do that. The workshops, again, they're based on the hero's journey. And the last chapter in my book is called Supremely Supportive Self-Care for the Journey. So part of what's really, really important is finding supportive structures and practicing them. and they could be in for body, mind, and spirit. You know, so that could be prayer and meditation. That can be breathing exercises, which are so important in our culture. A doctor at Columbia has said that we're experiencing an epidemic of oxygen starvation in our culture. We're so pressured we don't get proper breathing, you know, we don't get enough oxygen. So it could be that self-coaching is something that I teach and think is very helpful. So all that is in the book.
Talk about what your routine is now. You're looking back on this experience after a long time, a fairly long time. Mm-hmm. But I was interested in the routine that you had during that time of getting up and doing meditation. And so talk about what you do now.
Mm-hmm. What I do now is first thing in the morning, I read my inspiration for the day, which happens to be the Science of Mind magazine. And so I do a daily inspirational reading, and then I do meditate. And I often get really important downloads in my meditation, so I always keep a pad and pen so that I can jot down what comes to me in meditation that's going to be supportive during the day, something I should remember.
And do you people meditate in different ways. Some of them have walks. Some of them mm-hmm. have positions. I don't really know a lot about meditation, but I know that it can be practiced different ways.
Many, many different ways. I think breathing meditations are most common and taught because they're the easiest to focus the mind upon. I have a mantra meditation that sometimes I do, and sometimes I just drop into my heart center and concentrate on that. Other times I move up to my third eye and concentrate on that.
Well, I interrupted you. So you get up and then you do the meditation. And
yes.
Then you jot down the thoughts that came to you.
Yeah, and then I'm off and running on my day. And there are a couple of days a week where I do a very early yoga class. And on those days, I usually don't take time to meditate. I might do that later in the day. But those mornings, I'm just up and out to yoga.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then you said that you found at one point that you needed more meditation during the day?
Yes, that was when I was in Vietnam and I was still, still recovering from all of my, the painful broken bones. And also my head injury and neck had been reactivated in the second accident. So I really needed a little more downtime. And because we were being very active in Vietnam, I had to plug in an extra little meditation time. Yeah.
Well, another thing that was really startling in the book, at least, I mean, because I was reading it and reading about these different modalities, I guess you'd say, for healing and different things that you did. And then all of a sudden, this anger came out. You described this anger that kind of erupted.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of startling.
It was startling to me as well. Well, you know, anger is the second stage in the healing process. And sometimes we forget that anger is really grief. And that's such an important thing to remember. And in my grief, I was so frustrated that I couldn't remember things. It took a very long time for my brain to start working effectively again. Very long time. And one morning I was trying to meditate, I was trying to pray, I literally couldn't remember how to do it. And also I couldn't breathe properly. I had a respiratory therapist at one point. I could breathe as long as her hands were, you know, on my belly or on my chest and I could focus. But left to my own self, I just couldn't get enough air. So on this particular morning, I was trying to meditate. And then I thought, well, I'll pray. I couldn't remember to do anything. My mind was a big blank. So I just yelled out this, what turned out to be a very angry prayer, but it was, Jesus Christ, I'm supposed to be this healer and I'm supposed to be able to do all these great things and I can't even breathe. Why can't I breathe? And then, of course, I started crying and carrying on. And then I had this very loving voice say, I will teach you to breathe. So, yes, I had angry outbursts sometimes, but I know enough about grieving to know that it's my grief.
And that brought it out, that yeah. got rid of it?
Yeah, it's a release. And I do think it's important that we find healthy ways to release anger. And one of the healthy ways is to write about it, journal about it.
Okay.
Yeah.
That sort of brings me to, who are you planning to read this book? Who are the readers? Who did you have in mind when you wrote it? Who, in your mind's eye, who is this meant for? Is it meant for people who are sick?
No, not at all. You know, what I learned is that, you know, the new midlife is now 30 years in our 40s, 50s, and 60s. So when I began doing workshops, I discovered there were women even in their late 30s who were saying, oh, I need to come to your, I need to read. So we're living so much longer, we get a very long span of midlife. And during that time, we are handling a tremendous number of challenges having to do with chronic illness, with injury, with death, with caring for other people, financial loss. You know, there's a whole new area in psychology now called compassion fatigue for those caretakers of people who are ill and dying. So there's lots going on during that
time. And the caretakers are often women. Are usually women.
They're usually women, like my sister who cared for her husband in her home for 3 years until he died last year. It's a tremendous strain physically and emotionally. So the readership, yes, I was thinking mostly of women, and yet, you know, men are so much more involved with our culture and with women in ways that they weren't in my parents' generation. Mm-hmm. So I find that men are very interested in this as well.
And what do you think that they can get from it? Do you want them to repeat some of the healing experiences that you found, or do you want them to find their own, or what do you want them to do?
I want them to do the same thing that we women need to do, and that is to learn more about compassion for ourselves and for others, and for the opposite sex, because we have lots of fixed ways of thinking about each other. And what I love about the word hero is that it's a genderless word. Hero comes from the name Hera, and Hera was the Greek goddess who was married to Zeus. So the whole point of this journey has to do with learning to be compassionate, to be loving, and to be accepting and understanding of times when we're ill, we're not functioning well, or just times when, you know, we tend to be judgmental of people. And we need to dissolve that into compassion.
If you had a choice of not having the original accident and not having the difficulties that you had later on, but not finding all this kind of wisdom and power. I think the book's about power a lot. Would you want that to happen? Was it worth it, I guess I'm saying?
Yeah. I think it's always worth it, but it's only worth it as you look back. When the initial experiences are happening, and certainly, you know, if death is involved, nobody chooses that. And that's why on the hero's journey, the first stage is the call to change. What do we do with that usually? We ignore it. We don't want that, particularly the kind of changes that we're facing. No, we would never choose them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why the next stage is being tossed on the path. I mean, you're just out there. You're just in this space of unfamiliar terrain, and you have to begin to cope with it.
Talk a little bit about power, because There were times when you felt completely powerless for a long time.
Yeah.
And in sort of frightening experiences. I mean, what comes to mind is when you, that experience when you got in the wrong car New York to go to the airport. Oh.
Yes.
Do you want to describe that a little bit?
Oh, my. Yes, I had been helping my daughter, the journalist, settle into a new apartment in New York. And I called for a car, always called for a car, to take me to the airport. And so at the proper time, I got a call and I went down and hopped into this car. And I'm on my way to the airport in the back seat, and I get a call from the company that I called saying, well, we're here. Where are you? And, oh, my God, I was startled and stunned and terrified because literally I was in a car that was not the car. And this big guy driving the car was totally uncommunicative, hadn't said anything to me. So I thought, I'm being abducted here, you know. Mm-hmm. So it was a scam. I mean, I was terrified, and I had to keep my wits about me.
And the person on the phone told you were being abducted.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
Yeah, that I was in the wrong car, and it's a scam, and they somehow switch into their phone line, so they get there first.
Is that what happened?
That's what happens.
So they intercepted the
mm-hmm.
call.
Yeah.
And then, oh, dear.
Yeah. Anyway, I literally, I'm here, so I was okay, and I reported it and all that stuff. It's basically a money scam rather than a, you know.
It's not taking you off someplace and kidnapping you.
No, but I didn't know that at the time.
No, no.
So it was pretty, and that's where the mighty woman, you know, mantra came in. It's okay, you know, I am mighty. I am powerful. And I love that you raised the idea of power because, you know, we are either in a place of empowerment or we're being a victim. And that's the choice we get to make. Even when it seems like we're being a victim, you know, are we going to choose that? Or are we going to be empowered in every way we can possibly be? And it makes me think of Nelson Mandela. He's in prison for 27 years. He was never a victim.
Hmm.
And he chose to be empowered even when he left, and he forgave his prison guards. Because that's an act of empowerment.
But that's something that he can do. The women who are reading your book can't do that. How do they empower themselves?
Well, I found that the most important person I had to forgive constantly was myself, because I felt like such an idiot a lot of the times. Really, when I couldn't do the simplest of things, you know, like I couldn't set my alarm clock, so I had to borrow a little wind-up alarm from my neighbor. I mean, these are simple things, and you feel retarded. So I had to keep forgiving myself constantly for not being able to be the person I wanted to be during that time.
Okay, that's one way you get power, is to forgive yourself.
Mm-hmm.
How do you come into yourself so that you really feel the power?
I think by remembering who you are, one of the things that I've learned from ego state psychology, it's called, but also my coach's training, is that who we are is not our little egos who say nasty things to us and who tell us that if we're not able to work and be productive and make a lot of money, that we're just a failure. So it's remembering who you are in the sense of your core self, your essence, what you stand for. That's your power in the world.
Let's talk a little bit again about the workshop that you're going to be doing the day after this interview.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I'd love to talk about that because I'd love to see all of you listeners there. It will be again from 2 to 5 on Sunday the 15th at High Desert Yoga and Healing Center. And I'm going to be talking about a lot of aspects from the book and again set in the context of the hero's journey. And we'll also be talking about the challenges, the opportunities, how we find our life purpose on this journey, and the whole idea of being a warrior for that purpose.
And where do they I should say I'm talking to Gail Feldman, and I'm talking about her book, Midlife Crash Course, and it was a crash course in many different ways, The Journey from Crisis to Full Creative Power. Where do they find the workshop?
You can go online to High Desert Yoga, Albuquerque, and click on workshops, and you can find it there. Or if you're just coming, High Desert Workshop is, I mean, High Desert Healing and Yoga is on Copper between Carlisle and San Mateo.
And that's 2 to 5 on Sunday?
2 to 5 on Sunday.
The 15th.
Yes.
April 15th.
Yes.
Are you still practicing? Do you still have patients, or are you doing more workshops and writing?
I'm doing it all. I have a smaller clinical practice. because I'm doing these other things, and also I'm going regularly to San Diego, which is my original home, but I go there once a month, and I also see clients there.
I think we should mention some of the books, some of your other books, because there are other realms that you've gone into before this.
Mm-hmm. My first book is called Lessons in Evil, Lessons from the Light, and it was about a woman I treated who was raised in a generational satanic clan. So it's a very powerful book. It's Random House published it, and I was all over the country, and it was a difficult topic. But if you pretend that it's fiction, you can read right through it. And then my book, From Crisis to Creativity, has a lot of spiritual healers, artists, and it's about the relationship between the grieving stages and the stages in creativity.
And getting to create, or using mm-hmm. it for creativity.
Yeah.
Yes, that's mm-hmm. an exciting concept also.
Right.
And then this book is Midlife Crash Course, and of course it's using all these experiences and the healing from the experiences to get to a place where you're sort of wiser, you're more adept.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And I think that's the developmental task and mission for all of us on this journey, that during this time in life, we really are supposed to be getting to wisdom. And wisdom has to do with becoming an authentic person, giving up those personas, those identities that have seemed important to us but are no longer are. Mm-hmm. We really get to the core of our values and being that person.
Okay, and I'm talking to Gail Feldman, and you can hear from her more if you want at tomorrow from 2 to 5 at
High Desert Yoga.
In Albuquerque.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much for sharing with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
You are listening to Gail Feldman talk about her new book, Midlife Crash Course, The Journey from Crisis to Full Creative Power. I'm Susan Lubay for Women's Focus.